Hi, and welcome to The Hidden Island. I'm Matt McRae.
And I'm Daniel McRae.
And we are bros. But not like watch me do this cool backflip bros. We're actual brothers. So today, we are talking about climate change and natural disasters on Prince Edward Island. But before we get started, we'd like to do a shout out to our sponsor. This episode of The Hidden Island is brought to you by the Provincial Credit Union, the largest credit union in Atlantic Canada, with 10 branches across this beautiful province. If you are 25 or younger, there is a no-fee bank account with your name on it. That's right, no fees. So you can visit a branch or set up your account online. That's provincialcu.com. Why are we here talking about climate change?
For the last 16 years, I've been working with the McPhail Woods Ecological Forestry Project, doing environmental education and ecological restoration. And then the last couple of years, I've been getting to do some different research on different forests across the province. You know, it gives me a perspective. I don't know if it makes me an expert.
No, but we've reached out to all kinds of experts in this episode. You'll hear from a number of them. And although my focus has been human history, I also did, when I was working on my PhD, do an environmental history comprehensives. Got to have a better understanding of that interaction between natural history and human history and how the two really aren't separate. And I think that actually brings us to our next point, nailing down some of the terms we're going to be using in this so that people understand what we're talking about and we can all agree what we mean when we talk about climate change or what we mean when we talk about natural disasters.
Think about, natural disasters. How do you tease apart? We tend to call them natural disasters, but they're usually very connected because we're part of the ecology of anywhere we're living. And so, you know, they're generally very connected with the actions that our human culture and history has enacted on the land. Because sometimes when we call them a natural disaster, it sounds like, you know, it's out of our hands. And really, we've had a big part to play in the way that they've kind of happened in the island's history.
Absolutely. I think, too, it's just when we expand our idea of what a natural disaster is, because it's not just nature that causes disasters, it's humans. But that disaster can have natural effects and implications, a human disaster. A good example of that might be climate change.
Definitely.
And of course, when we're talking about climate change, we're not just referring to global warming, which is part of the process for sure. We're seeing that with hotter summers here on PEI.
Definitely.
But climate change is a natural process. It happens regardless of whether humans are here or not. But what the difference is, I think we can both agree on this, is that this recent round of climate change that we're experiencing is much accelerated compared to historic climate change, and is driven by fossil fuels that are produced by humans.
Definitely. And then the feedback loops through habitat destruction and all those ecological balancing points that would offset carbon and sequester it back into soils or permafrost or things like that. So it's kind of a coupled thing where we're creating this negative feedback loop that keeps worsening it.
Absolutely. I think one kind of evidence of how we've worsened things and how we've created, in a way, natural disasters is when you look at the effects of what I think we all think of when we think of natural disasters right now, Hurricane Fiona.
Definitely. Fiona was huge. And one of the things really connected to me to Fiona, I mean, we're all connected because of the experience of Fiona, which was, for my generation, completely, kind of unheard of, right? Part of my work is I've been running, last time I was on the podcast, I was talking about black ash trees. This is one project I've been running. But the other research project I've been looking at is our coastal forests that are in those windblown areas. Some of the highest recorded wind speeds during Fiona were at East Point, and that's one of my study sites. So I had been looking at these forests for about a year and a half prior to Fiona hitting. Much as, the post-Fiona depression hit me pretty hard. After that cleared up, you kind of went, wait, this is such an opportunity to look at how these windblown coastal Krumholzing forests dealt with what we were calling at that time a very historic event, right? And it was just fascinating to get that opportunity to look at that afterward. So it really started to make me shift the way I've been thinking about Fiona and the story of how it came to be and the damage that it did wrought.
Gotta ask Dan. Actually, before we do that, can you tell us, just for those that haven't heard the last episode, if you haven't listened to the episode on the Island's Forest, listen to it now. We'll wait for you here. Okay, you're done? All right. Perfect. Going forward, Dan, can you tell us quickly what the Krumholz forests are and then what the effects of Fiona were on them?
Of course, yeah. Krumholz is a German word that we've borrowed. If you head over to Newfoundland, they would call these windblown forests the Tuckamore. But Krumholz, effectively, Krum means crooked or bent. Holz means wood. And so it's just a kind of describing the windblown shape that these trees kind of take on through the growing conditions that they're growing in these windy coasts. So they kind of start growing upwards, but the high winds and sands and salts and ices and desiccating forces will kill those top growing buds, and it will kind of shift to a sideways or a lateral growth. So you end up getting these really angled, gnarly looking trees, often spruce, that will kind of grow along our windblown cliffs from East Point right to Greenwich and inside our dunes and those kinds of places. So they make up this kind of, not one habitat type, but this mosaic of vegetative protection that's slowing erosion, breaking wind speeds down, and providing habitat for so many migrating and resident animals.
The pictures you've shown me, they almost look like kind of these huge, bushy growths, you know, with some parts that are green, but some parts that are just these windblown branches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a really, like, it's not an environment you'd want to go for a walk through, generally speaking, unless
you are.
A
lot of thorns and spikiness. You know, I've got a lot of torn pants from the study. The coolest thing, as I started looking through some of the history of these coastal sites, you know, the first Europeans who were arriving here that we have writings from were writing about them. You know, they talk about these coming up onto the coast into these impenetrable thickets or ramparts of brushwood. These things were here for hundreds of years, and a lot of these times in these harsh growing conditions, trees kind of extend their lifespan. So we've got some really large specimens up at East Point, which is one of the less disturbed kind of Krumholzing sites. And I, you know, I don't know how old they are, but they might be quite old. You know, they may not predate the fires up there in the 1700s, but they might be 150-year-old trees, even though they're only 20 feet long, not even tall, because they kind of grow sideways. But yeah, but they're this important ecosystem that used to just border the whole island perimeter anywhere there was high winds. Those roots and everything else would be kind of protecting that island from erosion, which obviously is increasing with bigger storm events and climate change and lack of sea ice in the winter and all these things we're experiencing in the last couple of decades.
So what was the effect of Fiona on these Krumholz?
Well, I was worried. They're gnarly landscapes, but I've really grown to love them. There's a lot of just fascinating plants and animals that use them. They're kind of epic landscapes, especially on a place like PEI, where a lot of it's this gentle rolling hillscape, and going out on these seaside cliffs with salt sprays and eagles perched and foxes. And I was worried about these habitats, and I got to go out. There was one site particularly, one of my favorite sites along the Clear Spring Cliffs, and I was out the day before Fiona and got pictures and data from that day. And then as soon as my power came back on and my family was able to eat without a barbecue, I could get back out to the field. So I was there about a week and a half after Fiona, and there was almost no damage. There was a little bit of erosion, of course, because they were big waves, but no trees blew over. Bit of browning on some of the foliage and needles, but that all came back this year when I went back out to inspect this growing season. Compared to some of the inland forest, we're not talking about 75% blowdown. We're not looking at roots ripped out everywhere or tangle. You know, as soon as you get through that rampart, then you can start having more exposed wind damage. But it was really neat how well they fared, because they've just been conditioned their whole life to deal with high winds. They've strengthened their roots. They've adjusted their wood form. You know, that's what they're meant to do. Even their shape is more aerodynamic than a standard, inland tree.
Okay, so we have the coastal Krumholz surviving Fiona way better. Let's talk about the hidden history of hurricanes.
You know, I keep hearing Fiona was a historic storm. And yes, you know, we're on a history podcast. Of course it was historic. That's why we're talking about it. But the thing that I've kind of, the conclusion I keep coming to is, as I've, you know, looked at wind records and different things and other people's research who have done really great work compiling kind of the history of different wind events on PEI. And there's been some great studies in Nova Scotia as well, just next door. And the fascinating thing I came to realize is that wind events are really common on PEI. William Glenn, who did some really great historical research going through old Guardian articles and journals of British pioneers and some of the French settlers looking at when they mentioned big wind events, he counted 48 major weather events since 1775.
Okay.
Sorry, 1776. 1 year off. But still, 48 of those. And 28 of those events mentioned significant tree damage. If we do a simple little math on that, right, then we're getting big events every 10 years. There was a more official study done that he did a kind of historical looking at Guardian articles and that kind of thing, almost like a survey. There was a more kind of statistical calculated scientific study done in the forests of Nova Scotia, and their conclusion was they should be getting a fairly large wind event somewhere in the province every 7 to 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah. We live on a post-tropical storm track, and the further south we go to Florida, the more often these things occur. You know, and I find it interesting, just relating to the Black Ash Project I'm working on, you know, most of those seeds for many of our native trees are dispersed by wind, and they just happen to all ripen right around hurricane time. So they're relying on these storms to be able to disperse and migrate their species and their population further, right? That's how we got here after the glaciers in the first place. That's how the trees got here, was moving north through winds and dispersal through animals and birds and all kinds of things, right?
So what you're telling me is that the trees on Prince Edward Island basically evolved to rely on large wind events to propagate.
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, there's been studies, not as many studies in the Maritimes, but further south and same Wabanaki forest type into Maine and New Hampshire, there's been studies done looking at the fact that the major way our forest shifts and changes is through these wind disturbances. Now, normally, Fiona was a big event where some forest blew down, you know, 80% of the trees plus came down in some areas. That's too big. What we're talking about usually in a healthy, larger, older, resilient, multi-age forest is that you'd get these patch blowdowns that would create these lovely little clearings in the forest where the young hemlock that were growing in the shade would come back up. And studies in Nova Scotia have actually linked most of the old hemlock groves to wind events, classic storms from the 1800s and the 1700s.
So can you point to, like in the last, let's say, 100 years, has there been a storm that struck here on PEI that was similar to Fiona?
The late Boyd Beck and Alan McCachran from Western University.
Yes.
I found some articles from them and some talks by them that talk about a storm called Hurricane 5, because we weren't naming them. And this happened in 1923. And this storm is fascinating because out of those 48 storms that I mentioned that William Glenn found in The Guardian, they missed this one. This one really got underreported for some reason, and yet it is maybe one of the more destructive storms we've had, probably in the top five the PEI has recorded. This storm ended up damaging or destroying approximately 60 wharves and bridges across PEI. It also hit the Greenwich Dunes incredibly hard. Now, these dunes had been grazed and farmed and denuded. They weren't in the state they are now, right, thanks to Parks Canada's stewardship. Prior to that, they were in an ecologically pretty damaged state, and the dune system just couldn't take the winds and the waves, and actually 5 kilometers of the Greenwich Dunes moved 500 meters inland. And Parks Canada did a 75-year study watching the recovery of that secondary dune system that's behind the primary dunes. The very cool thing after Fiona, sad, the dunes got damage. On average, where I measured, I'm sure there's better measurements than mine, but on average, you know, many of them lost 10, 12 meters of front dune. But that secondary dune system, that very fragile dune system, fared just fine. There's a little bit of wind blow, of course, but it's nothing unmanageable. It's nothing like those forests we've watched just crumple.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that really fascinating, because that's the primary, a healthy primary dune should be able to lose some sand and recover reasonably quickly. You know, not ideal, but that's part of its job, is to take the brunt of that force. And so because we let it be for 75 years and actually recover ecologically, it had that natural resilience to come through an even more powerful storm better, which I find kind of amazing.
What I'm hearing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is that one of the reasons the 1923 Hurricane 5, which sounds like an amazing band.
Yeah, that's true.
But one of the reasons Hurricane 5 was so devastating for the island, with so much damaged infrastructure, and I remember you showing me the newspaper articles where they talked about Charlottetown and all the trees down. It looks like it could be an article from Fiona, right?
Yeah,
talking about the damage of Fiona. It's almost kind of eerie to read it.
They talk about how the grocers and hardware stores had to stay open extra late with lineups around the block to supply kerosene and candles because the electricity was gone for days. which I just find fascinating because it's kind of similar to the generator lineups and petrol lineups that were happening after Fiona, right?
You know, everything,
just kind of history repeating itself.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that the effects were so bad for Hurricane 5 was because of the transformations in the landscape that humans had done over the last couple, you know, last 200 or so years to the island.
Yeah, one of the big differences between Fiona and Hurricane 5 is the state of the island's ecology. In 1923, our tree cover was very low. You know, when 400 years ago, we were 98% plus forested. Large, multi-age forests of hardwood and mixed species that were resilient and biodiverse and meant to cope. Not to say trees wouldn't fall in the wind, but they were meant to cope with this. By farming right up into our cliffs and into our dunes, which happened all through the national park area and across the island pretty much, we took away that Krumholzing ecosystem that is meant to take the first barrages of wind and wave and salt in these storm events. So we really lowered the resiliency. And in 1923, with no tree cover, you know, when you look at the newspaper articles, as you said, it talks about Charlottetown and Georgetown losing their beautiful historic trees and people lamenting much like they did after Fiona. But it was coastal flooding that ended up being one of the most damaging effects of it. You know, it killed crops. The grain crop was highly damaged. Potatoes actually made it through all right, apparently. But the wharves, bridges, there was one bridge, I think, that was 5 kilometers upstream that got washed out. Just kind of amazing that some of these, the storm surges were just not slowed by any existing vegetation. And so they were able to deeply move inland, which we've seen after Fiona. You know, in areas without much vegetation cover in Fiona, I could find sea debris and buoys and all kinds of stuff 250, 300 meters into the forest. In areas with like healthy Krumholz, they were usually stopped within 50 meters by the trees and shrubbery that would catch everything. Well, when we're talking about historic forests and the history of forests on PEI, we have to mention Dr. Douglas Sobey. He actually is out of the University of Ulster in Ireland, but he's a research associate with the Institute of Island Studies here on PEI. And he did just amazing looking through all the journals and historic and archives for a whole bunch of early descriptions of the forests of PEI, right from 1534 right to 1900. So it's just an amazing resource of information. We had the lucky opportunity to pick his brain about some of the history of climates and forests on PEI.
Area of Freetown, which is interior, you know, it's inland from Bedeque. Between 1820, 1840, you can work out that about a quarter of the land had been cleared. You know, they have to give the amount of clearance for each. By 1861, the whole area was settled. It was very rapid, this clearance. It would be like the Amazon, you know, today, or somewhere people move in and very quickly clear the area. The diaries of Horatio Mann, in 1840 when he came, he was traveling along the road from Charlottetown to Hunter River and the Old Malpeque Road, and he just commented on the progress in the land, how clearings are occurring everywhere and log houses have appeared and such. The British colonial period, fire was also quite common because they used fire to clear the debris, often be done over the fall winter period, and they had to get rid of it fairly quickly. Fire was extremely damaging to resources on the island. Government tried to regulate it with proclamations and such, but it was almost impossible to control. And another comment, I think it's Walter Johnson makes, is that wherever the forest is cut into for a road, it's prone to wind damage because the wind can get in there. The wind would skirt over the top of the forest, you know, but once it catches on the trees, the roadways then would get blocked with fallen trees. This would just be probably normal wind events, you know, apart from you know, hurricanes and such. And this would also be true of the settlers' individual woodlots. You know, the wind would catch the trees on the edge. And I suppose it still does. This summer when I was on the island, you could see it from the roads, you know, the damage in areas where the island woods are so patchy nowadays that, you know, there are a lot of wet spaces for the wind to get into.
And I guess this brings us to another point, is the island and its environment and how it dealt with storms before Europeans, and how climate change affected the island before European arrival, because I think, of course, the Mi'kmaq have been here for 12,000 years, possibly more, but the forests have only been here for about 5,000 years?
Oh, well, a little more. I mean, after the glacier... The glaciers, which happened from roughly 25,000 years ago to 12,000 years ago-ish, that left the island as kind of a bare sandstone rock. Most of the soil was scraped off the highlands, right? That's why we don't really have sandy beaches down a lot of the northeastern coast of North America. The glaciers just took all that sand and bulldozed it further south to Florida. But the island was fairly denuded and very tundra-like originally. You know, and so when the Mi'kma'ki arrived here, it was a tundra ecosystem. Many of the trees we know now, but some of them not there. You know, hemlock and beech and sugar maple had yet to arrive, right? So it was this tundra ecosystem, which, weirdly, a tundra ecosystem is very similar to an island coastline nowadays in winter. Windy, exposed, poor soils, high winds, dry. Even though there's water everywhere, it's all frozen, right? And so many of those trees that were adapted for that tundra system now live along our coasts. It's those same species, you know, many from the heath family, like sheep laurel and cranberries and blueberries and things like that, as well as our spruce trees and some of those. So there's been this shift in climate. About 4,500 years ago, we were actually a degree or so warmer than we usually are now. And then that's actually cooled a little bit since then. So we've always had this kind of gradual climate change process. We had humans on the island that were acting as part of the ecosystem, rather than trying to change that ecosystem to be exactly what they wanted, right? And so that allowed for this ability to exist with that without the same amount of damage that we're seeing nowadays from some of these events.
Basically, things are relatively working in harmony. The system is designed to deal with the windstorms that come up here on a semi-regular basis, and then enter the Europeans.
Yeah.
And enter farming and clearing of the land and removing the forest from 98% cover to less than 20% cover, about?
There's warnings in the 1850s, and I'm sure earlier, that say we gotta be careful or we're gonna cut down all the trees and not have any trees on this island. By the 1900s, we were shipping in coal so that farmers could have fires to keep themselves warm because there wasn't enough fuel wood for fencing and for burning in your farmhouse. I don't have the exact stat, but yeah, we were below 20% forested. Nowadays, we've regrown some of the extent, so we can claim we're, you know, in the 40-ish% to 50% forested. We have a little bit more forest land than we did in 1923, but the trees, on average, our diversity's lower. Many of the stands are even aged. Some are made up of mostly non-native species that aren't adjusted to our climate and our weather event. Many of them are much smaller and weaker. We have a very different kind of forest than we used to. So it's not just the amount of forest cover. Now we can say we have this much forest cover, but it's very fragmented. And when you have small stands of trees, they're much more wind exposed.
With the arrival of Europeans, and probably beforehand too, there was other types of natural disasters. It wasn't just the windstorm, of course, right? And so I want to talk a little bit about fires, fish kills, and pests that we deal with. The other natural disasters, I'm going to put that in air quotes.
Fire is a natural substance, but most of the fires in PEI that we can look at, the grand ones, are human-caused. Same with the effects of Fiona. You know, the major historic thing to me about this hurricane is the state of the island's ecology. You know, we've had big storms before, but generally the island either had less trees or a lot more healthy trees. Fires are an interesting one because, again, naturally in our ecosystem, as far as ecologists have studied in the Wabanaki-Acadian system, fires are not a major component. You know, further north in the boreal forest, they do act as a disturbance agent to help age and change and shift biodiversity. But here in our region, really, they're not supposed to be a major part of it. Vast fires are kind of unheard of in the Maritimes.
And yet we have them. In the 1700s, there's lots of records. East Point all the way to St. Peter's, there was just a massive swath of destruction that happened during the French regime. So, of course, the French did not clear the land anywhere near as much as the later British regime did. But nonetheless, this fire destroyed huge swaths of eastern PEI's forests. And when the British settlers came after the French had been deported, they recorded that the damage was still there and still, you know, it took generations for that to fix.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, and fire was used as a way of land clearing, both by the French and by the British as well. And the attention to that safety of the spread of that fire wasn't always seen as a bad thing, right? If you cleared a few more acres of land from this vast primeval forest and you weren't burning up good mass wood, you know, that wasn't necessarily considered a bad thing. Laroque, from 1752, quotes about this grand fire from St. Peter's right to East Point, and he says, "The land is a desert owing to a fire, but a short distance inland, the country is covered with hardwoods." And the East Point had been reduced to a wilderness by a fire. There's been grand fires in the western part of the island. There was a great area, the Kaskumpek Cedars, that burned in the, I think, 1700s or early 1800s as well.
And there's been recent fires as well. I know in the 1960s there was a major fire up west.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And again, all of these, as far as I know, all the reports I've read have never really linked these to natural lightning strikes or other events like that. You know, we live in a wet ecosystem. It's getting a little less, but climate change. But, you know, historically, we get a lot of rain, a lot of snow cover, a lot of melt in the spring. And all of that keeps everything quite moist generally and makes fires kind of a hard thing to spread around compared to, say, the boreal forest, where fire is a much more of a natural part of that process.
And I think it's a human caused thing.
Yeah, well, it's that shifting of ecology, right? You know, when we open up the land and dry out the soils, there's a whole bunch of these pests that we've kind of either brought along with us on purpose or by accident, or we've changed the ecology to allow them to become an aggressive issue for us.
So for those of you that might not be familiar with this part of the island's history, both the French and the British,
yep,
in the 1700s and into the 1800s, dealt with massive waves of rodents just pouring out of the forests and into their homes and consuming everything, and literally you having to flee or climb a tree in order to avoid yourself getting covered in mice or voles, or I know there's some debate as to exactly what creature was responsible for some of these surges. But what you're telling me here too is that was also a result of human influence on the ecosystem.
Yeah, well, like
in part at least.
Definitely. I mean, there's some studies that have been done, not on PEI, but looking at the extinction of the passenger pigeon, you know, which was on PEI, the passenger pigeon, and the fact that it relied on acorns and beech nuts and other nuts and some of those foods that the mice and even the Mi'kmaq were eating as well. So the minute you remove, once that animal went extinct, right, you've got huge numbers of these nuts that are no longer being eaten. And so suddenly you've got them available for other species, right? And we don't understand the nuances of how this worked, but we've seen this in other ecosystems where you take out a player and you start changing the relationships in community and the balances that had been going on, and suddenly you get these unforeseen effects of population booms or sometimes population busts.
And I guess another one that's a bit more recent to talk about, because we don't generally have huge, you know, mouse surges currently.
Not anymore.
Well, we do have fish kills. This is a new natural disaster that we have across the island. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about that and what's behind that. And I feel like people think they know, but do they know?
Yeah, fish kills are often a bit of a hidden one. You know, we do hear about it a lot. But on average, we're getting one major fish kill a year for the last over 60 years. And they can come from a variety of reasons, generally related to a lack of healthy ecosystem coverage, usually forest and riparian zone coverage along our rivers, and often to land use practices adjacent, which often has to do with agriculture. And so it can be things like pesticide runoff, you know. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get better at that, you know. It could be siltation of rivers, you know. You could have the fast fish kill where there's a influx of nitrogen or some kind of poison like pesticides into the water. The poison obviously poisons things. The nitrogen can cause algae or other plants and things to bloom, which actually, as they grow rapidly, they take oxygen out of the water, effectively suffocating the fish. And you can have thousands of fish die, you know, in a day from these. Yeah, it's quite a crazy event that's happening. The biggest result that we see, kind of the flashy effect of the way that we've treated our rivers. We have other slower forms of natural disaster that happen on timescales we don't see as a disaster, because it's not in a moment or in a night. We used to have over 50 rivers that had breeding salmon. One of the major important things for salmon to be able to breed in a river is a rocky bottom. And as we farmed and denuded those soils and bared our riparian, our river zones, we had a ton more erosion and siltation So many of our rivers now are silted and sandy on the bottom, which doesn't allow salmon to breed. So at this point, we're down to, I think it's under 15 rivers that still have salmon breeding them, compared to over 50 that we used to have, you know, 150 years ago.
So it's almost kind of like that frog in the pot where you turn up the heat and you don't really notice it until it's almost too late, and all of a sudden you've lost this natural resource, you've lost this part of your ecosystem, and you've lost something that makes the island a beautiful and lovely place to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's the great conservationist Aldo Leopold, his I'm going to paraphrase because I'm not as elegant as him, but his quote was, everything in an ecosystem has its role and its job. If you're going to remove anything from that ecosystem or change it, its role and job become your job, right? And so we removed or changed some of the jobs of things without really understanding the jobs that we had to take on. There's so many great people on PEI and in the region who are now working on understanding, and not just understanding of it, starting to do that, those jobs, starting to take on. We've got watershed groups replanting, you know, and we've got good news from this. We've got river otters on PEI again. It's one of the larger mammals that was extirpated from PEI back in the 1800s. And because we've rehealed some of those rivers, not perfectly, but we've improved them, right? We've made those movements. River otters have moved in. We didn't release them. There was habitat available, and they came and found it, right? And that's the cool thing about nature, is the solutions are kind of there. We know great species to plant, and we know how to build some healthier forests than, you know, what we've got. Do we know all the answers? No, but we can make those first steps really, really easily, you know.
I've got this great mental image of the an otter getting on the Wood Islands ferry and saying,
exactly.
I'm going to check. I heard there's some good real estate on the island now. I'm going to check it out.
A little suitcase.
Yeah, a little suitcase, ready to go. So we've talked a lot about the past, which is a history podcast, but I'd still like to talk a bit about how this past influences our present and the future.
History yet to be. So there's a lot of different predictions, lots of great science being done. We have a whole climate change lab on PEI, right? That's kind of crazy. We have the UPI Climate Change Lab out at Greenwich. We've got a whole research facility using this whole island as a living laboratory, you know, which is amazing. Presently, you know, even just anecdotally, I think we can all talk to the fact that the weather's different. You know, I've been working outside most of the time for the past 15 plus years. And when I started doing that, we didn't get droughts every year. In the last several, you know, 5-6 years, most of our summers, one of the months, July or August, is a pretty droughty month. And that's starting to shift that, you know. We're even starting to have trees kind of put on, they'll grow a bit and then they'll kind of harden off, and then they go through actually several growing seasons during a year. So they kind of go through bouts of growth. And most of my career at this, two growing seasons was the norm. And sometimes we get a third. If we get enough moisture and enough heat, they'll put on a third growing season.
Yeah, well, and I think you can see those effects even in the heritage industry, believe it or not, because, of course, this past summer at Yo House, which is up at Green Park, mm-hmm. on the western end of Prince Edward Island, it's an old house built in the 1860s, and we had mold, something we've never really dealt with before.
Crazy.
Mold just growing. And we've had that at some other sites, too, where mold has started to appear, and it was due to that massive heat and humidity that everyone says the word gets used, unprecedented.
Yeah.
Heat and humidity.
We're known for mild winters and cool summers, right? We're a maritime climate.
Exactly.
And we're starting to have like deeply cold winters sometimes and hot summers. I don't know, when we were kids, if you got a beach day where things were hitting 24 degrees Celsius, that was an awesome beach day.
That was a whopper.
Yeah, and nowadays I feel like I'm constantly planting trees in 30 to 40 degree temperatures, which was unheard of. I don't remember that as a child on PEI.
No, and I don't think that's just like the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia either. You know, things were cooler when I was a kid. I think things
the
were
90s
cooler.
Were cool, so, you know, exactly. They were cooler. Yeah, no, but some of the predictions are... I always take these with a grain of salt because we're guessing, you know, very educated guessing. I'm not trying to belittle any of the science done, but we don't know how the feedback loops and different things are going to work in ecology. They're complicated, interconnected systems. But, you know, one really scary example is that both scientists, some local researchers, there's William Glenn's work again, but also Parks Canada's looking into this in the region on their own, too. I've heard them talk about it. And, you know, white spruce, right, that tree that grows along our coasts, that refills our old fields after we're done farming them, it's kind of one of the most populous trees on PEI. It's not really expected to grow here beyond 2075. So in 50 years, white spruce isn't, we're supposed to not be in its proper range anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. That's kind of mind-blowing to me. You know, this is a tree that often we use as the first species when we're re-afforesting an old field or something like that. It's what naturally does that on PEI. And, you know, it's predicted to, in the maritime region by that, by, you know, 2100, only be growing maybe in the highlands of Cape Breton and up towards northern New Brunswick and into Quebec.
Wow. That's a lot of wows on my part. But I think we're starting to see those effects happen. We were told for so long, yeah, climate change is going to have these effects, and now we're seeing it. And, you know, I think we have some people here, some experts we've talked to, who can kind of fill us in a bit more about some of the effects we're seeing on Prince Edward Island, the ones that we might be more familiar with. For example, we have Peter Nishimura, who is a climate change policy advisor and manager of Climate Action Secretariat for the PEI government.
My name is Peter Nishimura. I am currently manager of the Climate Action Secretariat within PEI Department of Environment, Energy, and Climate Action. The work that we do and the work that I do is primarily in the area of climate adaptation. So we look mostly at impacts of climate hazards in PEI and how they'll worsen over time. And then also what we call adaptation. So that's, you know, how can we adapt or change our behavior in order to minimize those impacts. So climate change in PEI has been constant over history, but probably our understanding of that change has evolved and improved over time. You know, we've observed annual average temperatures increased, you know, half a degree over the past 50 years. Total annual precipitation has decreased slightly, but the nature of that precipitation has changed a bit and how it falls. Sea level rise has occurred about 30 centimeters over the past 100 years. And so those changes are projected to increase over the next few decades, and that's going to lead to these climate events that we're seeing. So extreme heat events, intense rainfall events. With sea level rise, we'll be seeing water, coastal flooding reaching farther inland. And we expect as ocean temperatures increase as well, that we'll see more intense storm activity, tropical storms and hurricanes. And that'll be, of course, have an impact on our coastal communities as well. With these changes that we've observed and the changes that we anticipate, climate change is being recognized as more and more of a priority, and it is starting to shape some of the action and the plans that we're making going into the future. Climate change has been on the radar for PEI for a few decades. I can think of research on sea level rise here 20 years ago. Lots of different government strategies that we've been a part of. There are a lot of things that we need to do, and there's still a lot of gaps. I think I would probably land on two things, you know, that we need to do for a more sustainable future and a more resilient future. We really need to turn our focus toward vulnerable populations. You know, those within our communities that are more vulnerable to climate impacts, you know, and that includes women, low-income individuals, you know, those who lack proper housing, BIPOC populations. Second, I think we need to be more ambitious. Right now, the current pace of action, the scale of investment right now that is going into adaptation, I would say, needs to be increased in order to keep up with the challenge of the worsening impacts. So I think we really need to think bigger. And we need to think with the next generation in mind. Otherwise, I think the legacy that we're going to leave won't be one that we're proud of. So those two pieces around focusing on vulnerable populations and really increasing the level of our ambition really are key, you know, if we're serious about creating a sustainable future.
You also mentioned the UPEI Climate Change Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Donald Jardine, who's associated with that lab, and we were talking to him about some of the effects of climate change and what it's having and what that means for the island.
There are a number of impacts. Of course, flooding is one of them. You can get what we call coastal flooding, which is when you have a storm like Fiona, the water comes inland and floods low-lying areas. Extreme weather also is showing having a lot more intense storms. Crop damage is a big thing. With Fiona, we saw some places lose a lot of trees. Some places lost 75% of their tree coverage. Then there's coastal erosion of cliffs and dunes and sandbars and everything, anything along the coast. Our land use planning here is a bit hodgepodge. I think it's 11% of PEI have municipal planning, and the rest of it is controlled by the provincial government. Like all the rural areas don't have official planning zones. A province-wide land use plan that considers climate change and preparing for climate change, how people can prevent themselves from being impacted. And some of the other things included in that would be to stop coastal development in low-lying areas, like under 5 meters above sea level. I know people like to have their piece of land near the coast where they can see the water and all that. After a storm like Fiona, I mean, how many cottages have we seen float away? You know, and get flooded and damaged, and a lot of them, because they're not their primary residence, they have no insurance. Another thing is stop cutting trees and bushes in the buffer zone. There's supposed to be a 15-meter buffer around our coast, and that includes cottages. But the first thing a lot of cottage owners want to do is cut down all the trees in front of their cottage. So I want the view. There's this term that's used, kumultz, K-U-M-M-O-L-T-Z. It's a type of bush that adapts to that climate. It's like a stunted tree that grows along the coast. And you see them here in PEI. People say, oh, I don't like the look of those. You know, they're all, and I touch them and they scrape me, scrape my skin. And there's a reason why they're like that. They've developed the resistance, right? And so we shouldn't be cutting those things down. And so that's my little spiel about that.
So we got the chance to chat with Kate McQuarrie, who's head of forestry here on Prince Island, but also spends a lot of time trying to share facts about the natural history and heritage of Prince Edward Island.
She's an incredible botanist.
Qualitatively, we're seeing things like larger storms in the fall. One of the things that I'm really noticing a lot is we don't get as much ice off the coast in the winter as we used to. And that might not seem like a big deal, but that ice actually protects the sand dunes from some of those storms. So if you have a big winter storm when there's ice on the water, you don't get the waves hitting the shore, the dunes are protected. The warm winters and less snow has impacts on some of our insects, right? We don't have those deep, deep cold winters that kill off some of the bugs that we might not appreciate. Everybody's seeing a lot of earwigs around this year, right? We need some really good cold winters to kill those off. Some of the species, both plant and animal, may or may not be well adapted to the future climate that we have here. Climate is really complex, and the environment ecosystems are really complex. So if anybody can tell me that they know for sure how our climate is going to change, I'm going to raise my eyebrow and say, you know what, some of that might be right and some of it might be wrong. One of the things I'd love to see is an increase in forest area on PEI. So historically, I mean, if you could go in a time machine and go back about 300 or 400 years, roughly 98% of PEI would have been covered in forest. And today, less than half the island is forest, and the forest is much different than it was historically because so much was cleared and then just regrew in a very, very different way. Taking climate change in mind is, should we even be looking back at the historic forest? People will say, you know, well, don't worry about the Acadian forest that used to be here 300 years ago because we're not going to have the climate for that in the future. But again, I go back to that complexity, and there were a couple of dozen different tree species that are found in the Acadian forest, and I believe some of those will not do very well under what we think the climate will be in the future, and some of them will do really well. The relationships between them will change, and the distribution may change, but I don't think it's a matter of all of a sudden we're going to see some trees disappear because the climate isn't suitable for them here anymore. I think it's more a matter of, you know, they won't grow as fast, they may be more stressed, they may be more susceptible to disease, and the role they play in our forests will be different, but I don't think they're going to disappear altogether.
You know, islanders were really shaken by Fiona. Previously, I think in a smaller way, islanders were shaken by the effects of Dorian back in 2019 and Juan.
Definitely. And
even seeing, you know, even though the effects of Juan weren't as bad here as they were in Nova Scotia, seeing what happened to Halifax and seeing what happened was still kind of disconcerting. And I think there's been a lot of mourning for what we lost in Fiona because, you know, here in Charlottetown, for example, lots of trees went down. I think a lot of people lost trees in the yard. And the other side of that is maybe a small sense of being traumatized. I know that when I walk around now, or even drive in the countryside, and I see trees that are close to a house, my first thought is, those should probably come down.
Yeah, no, it's funny. One of my coworkers at McPhail Woods, we realized this year, you know, our job has always been educators and foresters and plant propagators and things like that. And this year, there's some environmental grief counseling as part of the job because you have people phone up and say, I lost 80% of my 30 acres of woods. And they're almost in tears, and you've got to, you know, hold the hand and explain through and come up with plans and work on a bad situation, you know?
We had at Beaconsfield, where my office is, we had this grand old tree out on the front lawn facing the water, and it was had five trunks, and it was just massive. And I have a picture of my daughter kind of, you know, having climbed in between the five trunks and supporting herself. And after Fiona, it survived, and I thought, wow, that is a tough old tree. But then we noticed that this gap between the five trunks was getting larger and larger. And when we had an arborist come look at it, they said, yeah, it's going to come down. Mm-hmm. It's coming apart. That weakened it, and there's, you know, it's terminal, essentially. And it was really kind of like, it did feel a bit like losing an old friend. That tree has been there probably for most of Beaconsfield's existence, yeah. if it's not older than Beaconsfield. Well, these are deeply personal connections. They're not rational on the level of like, oh, climate change is X and Y and these stats
mm-hmm,
exist.
Of course, yeah.
It's very much an emotional connection, and it really does bring home, I think, for a lot of people, the effects that this is happening. And I think the first step is, you know, for people's processing these feelings. And that's why we are lucky to have Stuart Hickox, the founder of PI Tree Stories, which was a group that kind of emerged out of Fiona to try to deal with some of this grief mm-hmm. around the trees specifically.
Some of the stories that I'm already getting have been just utterly incredible. Simple things like people just talking about the family tree that they planted that fell. We get a lot of those stories. You know, people talking about the favorite park that they went to. So it's not about the tree that we own necessarily, it's about the trees that we value that have always been there. There's a dawning recognition that these trees and these beings, these natural beings around us, in many ways we've taken them for granted. Trees in many ways are like the elders in our community, the older people. They provided shelter for us. They nurtured us and nourished us. And then suddenly when they're gone, we miss them. There's some really interesting stuff coming out of the Tree Stories Project too in terms of what we do now. The first thing that's happening is there are so many people doing innovative things with the debris from Fiona. I met a guy in Bedeque. It's not his full-time job to do woodworking. He has built a workshop in his garage and has explored turning bits of trees of different types into beautiful turned wooden bowls. It's just a hobby of his, and it's really taken off. To see the look in his eyes as he shows me the things that he's doing out of what many people consider to be junk or debris or waste, it's magical. The exciting thing about coming out of Fiona is so many people are getting involved in restoration process. So many people are getting into forestry. We see a lot more people offering planting tree services, et cetera, et cetera. I've mentioned some of the programs before, the 2 billion trees initiative and the province's commitment to 1.3 million trees. Again, I think it's about finding ways to integrate all of the expertise that's across the province, the people who are starting businesses to help clear up debris, the garden centers that are all like ramping up to sell new trees, the infrastructure of the nurseries that's needed to create those seedlings. It's not just one piece at a time, but it's more of a holistic approach to the long-term work that's needed.
I think there's a silver lining in this is that, you know, one of the things with Fiona that I've seen is there's a wake-up call. We're recognizing that some of the ways that we've treated our ecology have not done us well. They're not necessarily producing the economy we once thought, but they're also not protecting our ecology that we crucially live upon. There's that kind of wake-up call for these groups and other things coming together and starting to look at where do we go wrong and how can we do better moving forward for the whole community, human and otherwise, you know. And I think there's a whole bunch of ecological silver linings I've started to notice as well. We've got a lot of forests that were growing on depleted old fields, and they have a fresh supply of dead wood that's going to rot into wonderful soil. Part of an old forest is the ground forms a pit and mound topography, so kind of hillocks and little pits that form with water and provide habitat to amphibians and a whole host of plants and things. And usually most ecologists will say it takes about 150 years of time for that groundwork to develop naturally. And we basically got a 150-year topological evolutionary advancement on our ground in 6 hours. So I think that there's a number of ways that we can say, okay, you know, the storm is part of the ecology. So, you know, we can't deny climate change is going to make these happen more intensely and more often. But we can look at the ways that we can play with it or work with it or accept that it's happening, you know, and try to think about our shores differently and our waterways differently and the way that we're going to plan our forest cover and those protective elements that really come together to start mitigating some of the effects of this.
And I think this is a good point. There was an essay years ago that William Cronin did. I think it was called The Problem with Nature. Don't quote me on that. It might be wrong. Experts out there, please send us an email. But he talked about the fact that we often consider nature somewhere you go to.
Yeah.
Nature is out there and it's separate from us. As we've talked about, we've insulated ourselves in some ways from the effects of nature.
Definitely.
So those effects keep happening, but we haven't really felt them to the same effect. And maybe that's part of it with Fiona, is that we're feeling it and that we're more aware of the fact that we aren't separate. And nature is literally our backyard. Nature is literally our house. And inside the house, we're all part of this ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all have to start thinking as part of the ecosystem rather than as something separate or even worse, above it.
Exactly, yeah. You know, the above it is a bad vantage point. That's one of the things I love about natural history is, you know, the glaciers kind of left us around 12,000 years ago and the Mi'kma'ki arrived right at that time, maybe before. Hemlock trees, beech trees, oak trees, they didn't arrive until 6,000 to 4,000 years ago. So when we're talking about native species to PEI, humans are very much in the mix. We're not something new. Now, the cultures we brought with us and started changing that landscape, that is new. But humans being here and being part of the community, an important part of the community, that's thousands of years old.
I mean, I love that take on it. And I think that there are a lot of islanders who are using that take. We mentioned, of course, Mr. Hickox, but I think also we've got artists and you know, public speakers like yourself who are trying to kind of share that perspective, right? And, you know, I can think of a couple of projects. Help me out here. Who are we thinking of here who's done art? There's films about climate change.
Yeah, well, my partner, Melifiore Clarks, is a filmmaker who has done several different films dealing with the ways that we farm and climate grief. And we've got weavers like Rilla Marshall, who's actually doing beach weaving with the national parks during the summer, weaving cool things with kids out of beach trash and other natural materials that they can find. You know, even the Climate Lab has started to put on some art shows in their space, climate-themed art, so that people get out and visit and start connecting to that community. So I think that this is something that is just rising in the public conscious and the local conscious, you know, because it is on our doorstep. It's been on our doorstep, but it's so noticeable now for all of us, even, you know, those who aren't out in the woods every day.
I think another thing to note is we do have a lot of groups, community groups, and not-for-profit organizations that are taking action. Think of watershed groups. I know you've worked with a lot of them, and many of them, as you said, often the motivation is locally seeing that change, saying, I used to fish here and I can't anymore.
Yeah. The amount of older farmers who want to take their kids grand fishing to the same spot their grandfather took them and they can't now. That is that moment. I think personal connection is so important, because if we don't love the ecology around us, if we can't see it for what it really is, it's really hard to appreciate it and learn how to treat it better and protect it. And not only that, but then benefit from all those things that it provides.
And we've also got organizations like the Island Nature Trust that are, of course, trying to protect mm-hmm. larger amounts of land, because I think, as has been mentioned by one of our guests, PEI's got a unique situation compared to other provinces when it comes to land, because most of our land, unlike other areas that have huge swaths of crown land, most of our land are private.
Exactly, yeah. And there's different programs that are being done to help diversify and improve the health of some of these ecosystems and forests. And we've also got Parks Canada that has a whole swath of this windblown North Shore that they are working at stewarding.
The last question I have, you know, the average islander who's listening to this and wants to make a difference, maybe they haven't done anything yet, maybe they already are, but what would you say to someone? What can they start doing other than recycling and planting native species and things like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you mentioned, there's so many great groups. There's often a group in your local area. There's a whole bunch of island-wide groups, but there's many local watershed groups and other things like that. So there's lots of ways to get involved, whether it's through donations or time or effort. There's beach cleanups and all kinds of different events that get put on. Honestly, if you stop mowing, trees grow. The island was once 98% forested, not because a whole bunch of people planted it, but because that's what it wants to do. And climate change is going to shift, as we've talked about, shift species and the way that works, but we do know it grows trees. And so there's some areas of the coast. COVID was a really neat time to be walking the coast, because you had cottages where nobody could be there for a year or two. And when you looked at their lawn, it was just young spruce trees growing in the wind. the only thing that kept that as a grass lawn was mowing, you know. So if we just let some of those coastlines naturally recover, we can go in and enhance them with all kinds of other diversity and species and strategies to start strengthening that.
Amazing. I love this conversation. I've heard you talk before, but I really want to thank you for coming in today.
The Hidden Island Podcast is sponsored by the Confederation Center of the Arts, the Provincial Credit Union, and the Gray Group. Thank you to all our sponsors for their support. We'd also like to acknowledge the in-kind support of Food Island PEI, the Water Prince Corner Shop, and Upstreet Craft Brewing. The Prince Edward Island Museum and Heritage Foundation produces the Hidden Island Podcast, but that's not all that we do. We are responsible for protecting and sharing the human and natural heritage of this province. We are a not-for-profit foundation and rely upon the generosity of Islanders to continue producing amazing programming like The Hidden Island. If you are able, please feel free to make a donation to the foundation or to become a member. It's a great way to support us. You can do so by going to our website at www.peimuseum.ca. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Hidden Island.